If you're ready to dive back into seeing movies in theaters, we've got the perfect pick. In the Heights is a lavish, vibrant, charming, joy-filled musical.
It's set over the course of several very hot summer days in New York City and stars Anthony Ramos as a charming bodega owner named Usnavi, who has big dreams of returning to the Dominican Republic. I'm Aisha Harris.
And I'm Stephen Thompson. Today we are talking about In the Heights on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR.
Next up, ding!
Here with me and Aisha is Monica Castillo. She's an arts and culture reporter with Colorado Public Radio. Welcome back, Monica.
So glad to be here for this episode.
Thrilled to have you be here. Now, before Hamilton made him a household name, Lin-Manuel Miranda wrote the music and lyrics for the musical In the Heights. The Broadway production won 4 Tony Awards, including Best Musical. And as we mentioned at the top, the film adaptation stars Anthony Ramos as Usnavi. He hopes to return to the Dominican Republic, where he can live out the dream of his late parents. In fact, just about everyone in this story has big dreams and mountains to climb. Usnavi's young cousin, Sonny, played by Gregory Diaz IV, faces an uncertain future as an undocumented dreamer. Leslie Grace plays Usnavi's best friend, Nina. She can't afford to go back to Stanford, where she feels alienated. And her father, Kevin, played by Jimmy Smits, wants to make sacrifices to pay her way. Nina's boyfriend, Benny, played by Corey Hawkins, is trying to figure out where he fits in, while Usnavi is falling for Vanessa, played by Melissa Barrera. Vanessa dreams of leaving to launch a fashion career. She works in a salon that struggles to survive as the rent just keeps going up. And then there's Abuela Claudia, played by Olga Merides. She's a surrogate grandmother to the whole neighborhood. I could go on. I have not even gotten into Lin-Manuel Miranda's appearance as the Piragua guy. The movie was directed by John M. Chu, whose credits include Crazy Rich Asians and 2 of the Step Up movies. And the screenplay is by Chiara Alegria Hudis, who wrote the book for the original musical. After a long delay in its scheduled release due to the pandemic, In the Heights is finally out, both in theaters and on HBO Max. Monica, I'm going to start with you. What did you think of In the Heights?
I loved it. There are very few movies that already have me in tears by the time the opening studio credit shows up, just as the movie's beginning. It's basically Coco and In the Heights. And this one had me from the jump. It's just so beautiful, so jubilant. It is a celebration of everyday life. It is a celebration of the connections that bind us. You know, as you were saying, there's such a huge ensemble and everybody's great. I mean, it doesn't feel like there's a misstep in the whole movie. And for me, it's almost a little hard to talk about without almost crying. So I'll try to avoid that. But I do love how, you know, considering that it was delayed by the pandemic and, you know, the hype for In the Heights was already happening when everything was interrupted. And so now it does feel like this big return. It does feel like the celebration of, you know, the people who we rely on to get through the day. And it's just so beautifully done. I can't say enough good things about it, really.
All right. How about you, Aisha?
I also found this to be such a delight and such a pleasure to watch. I think, you know, in the 21st century, movie musicals are already pretty rare. And to paraphrase Stephen Sondheim, they all have to have some sort of gimmick in order to get butts into the seats. And sometimes that gimmick is we're going to cast a bunch of like famous non-singer performers. I think of something like Into the Woods, where we had Chris Pine and Meryl Streep. You have these big names that you don't necessarily want to see playing these roles. Instead, you want to see seasoned musical theater performers having a chance to be on the screen and bring those characters to life instead of casting these like quote-unquote bankable names. I think what In the Heights does really well, and what Lin-Manuel Miranda and John M. Chu and all of the creators have talked about, is making sure, like, no, we don't want to have these big names. We wanted to cast these lesser-known names, but who really fit these roles well. I love Anthony Ramos as Usnavi. He's been on my radar since Hamilton, but also I thought he was one of the best parts of the Netflix version of She's Gotta Have It. He just oozes this drive and this hunger that Usnavi has to have as a character. Also, he's very adorable. He has like these freckles and his ears, and he's just, I just love it. And so seeing all of these, you know, like on the cusp of being big stars, seeing them tackle these roles, it's just to me one of the best parts of watching this film. And it's great to see Black and brown actors being able to do this on screen, because so often Lin-Manuel talked about how he wanted to make stars and that the producers kept telling him, well, we need international stars like J-Lo or Shakira. Those names were thrown out. And I'm glad that they stuck to their guns and were like, no, let's not do that. Let's make stars instead of depending on the music industry to do that. So In the Heights gets like a big, big yay from me. I really loved it.
Yeah, I agree with everything both of you have said. I found this movie to be such a balm and such a joy and such a perfect movie to see as either your first or one of your first movies back in the theater if you feel comfortable going to the movies. This is such a Technicolor big screen just joy bomb from start to finish. And I loved it so much. And I really felt a couple times watching this movie, like, can you imagine the patience necessary to have gone through all the years of development that this movie went through, all of the false starts, all of the different studios, all of the different pressures that went into making this movie, and you finish it and it's supposed to come out in the summer of 2020, and it is this good and it looks this great and it has all these wonderful people in it, and then you have to sit on it for a year knowing you have made the movie that they have made. I think it is one of the most impeccably cast musicals that I've ever seen, and also just one of the least stagey stage to screen transitions that I've ever seen. This movie never looks like a stage production. Even though it is set in a fairly contained space, it's set within a neighborhood, it is just flying all over the place. It's from all these different angles. They deploy like clever little special effects. It is a completely cinematic experience, and I love it so much for that. I wanted to talk a little bit more about the kind of supporting performances. Monica, did you have a standout supporting performance you wanted to talk about?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of attention, and rightfully so, is going to go towards Olga Meredith, because not only is she like a great supporting character who shows up throughout the story and has these really great lines and these really emotional scenes, she then has this like show-stopping number, Paciencia y Fe, and it is,
oh my God,
incredible. Like, talk about something that's broken out of, you know, the sort of staginess of like, all right, we set up a camera and you guys just, you know, do what you do on Broadway. No. Parts of it are filmed in the New York Transit Museum. So you have these old school trains that she's using to tell her story and remember when her mother brought her from Cuba to the Heights and to Manhattan and what a culture shock that was and all the different changes and coldness that she faced trying to assimilate to her new home. And then there's this really colorful, beautiful ending. And I don't want to spoil it anymore, but it's just really astonishing to watch. You just wouldn't have gotten that on stage. John Entwistle obviously knows how to direct dance movies. He's done a few of the Step Up sequels. He knows what he's doing when he's shooting performances. He did Jen and the Holograms, and he also brought back the cinematographer, Alice Brooks, who worked with him on that one too, to work with him on In the Heights. So they know how to play with color. They really knew what they were doing when they were putting this together. And I think it shows.
Yeah, I want to speak briefly to the Olga Meredith's performance. That is a marvelous bit of casting. She played this role throughout the Broadway run of In the Heights. They got somebody who embodied that character for a really long time on the stage and was able to translate that to film so beautifully. I mean, I have a feeling we will be talking about that performance again come awards season, because that is a big standout. How about you, Aisha? Was there a supporting performance you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, I want to give a shout out to Gregory Diaz IV as Sonny, because I just loved him so much. I think this is the first time I've seen him in anything. And he's giving you like Disney Channel supporting character, but who steals who steals every scene he's in. Mm-hmm. And I mean that with like the greatest of compliments. Like, he's younger, he's hip, he's kind of sassy, but he also has heart, and he's also given his storyline that was not in the original show, about the Dreamers and DACA and being undocumented. And, you know, I don't necessarily know if that plotline works as well as I wanted it to. I didn't feel as though they did enough with that plot line. It kind of shows up and then recedes to the background again.
Yeah.
And I wish there had been a little bit more to that. But I think every scene he's in, he is great in. He is wonderful. And I have to also shout out the 96,000 scene, which he is another highlight in. And that is obviously, that's a song about everyone's hoping to win the lottery ticket. Mm-hmm. And Stephen, you were talking about the way in which this film feels like a movie and not like a stage version. This is a scene in particular where that comes to its apex. There are lots of like very cool little animated touches at the beginning of the scene where, you know, the characters are singing and some of the words will turn into animated images on the screen and flash for a second. There's a lot of really cool touches. And then there's the giant pool scene. And everyone's saying it's very Busby Berkeley. Very. Yes. But I'm also just getting a lot of Esther Williams. Mm-hmm. Loved it. And the choreographer was Christopher Scott. He does a really good job of bringing in all the elements of salsa and Latin dance into both a pool, melding it with all these different styles. And I'm gushing about this film, and I just think that I didn't get to see it on a big screen. I hope people do see it on a big screen. I might go back to the theater and see it on a big screen because a lot of the film was shot on location. And there are so many movies today where you can tell it was on a green screen. You can tell that they were kind of implanted someplace. And I appreciate that most of the scenes, except for a couple like fantastical moments, feel as though they are actually like it's happening in front of you on the street. You can feel the heat. You can feel the sweat. I just. Now all I've got is like exclamations, like sounds.
I'm glad you mentioned 96,000 because that really is one of those moments where this thing just kind of explodes somehow beyond the screen. Did you guys have any other musical numbers you wanted to shout out while we're just listing things?
I mean, I'll continue the 96,000 hype train, but overall in all the different musicals, I did want to shout out the dances because the choreography is really amazing. And for me, it was so moving to see like the different fusions. We have hip hop, we have ballet, we have jazz, we have contemporary, and we also have salsa. Having been a salsa dancer for about, I don't know, my lifetime. and I, you know, watching it on the big screen, I know some of the dancers. I've danced with some of the dancers. I've learned from some of the dancers on the screen because the New York salsa community is, you know, fairly tight knit, even though it's very big and it crosses all kinds of different boroughs. To see that and know, like, we have been otherized and we've been seen as, like, that's a music from somewhere else. That's not American. And New York City is the birthplace of salsa. So to see this big treatment from a Hollywood studio movie felt reaffirming. Like, just down to my bones. I was just, like, gushing, yes. Just beaming. I left the first time when I saw the movie just kind of on a cloud. I was just so happy and elated to see all these different pieces of both, you know, we're talking about identity, but we're also talking about gentrification. We're talking about, you know, the daily struggles of like, yeah, I don't have enough money for that. And, you know, I can't afford that apartment and I need a cosigner. You know, all these different things that the characters are going through are so inherently relatable. No one's like super special. There's no superpowers. It's just everyday folks singing and going through it.
I also appreciate the way in which there's history, little speckles of history thrown in here. There's a moment that really reminds me, and I don't know if this is what they were going for, where there's a shout out to a bunch of famous Latina women. And it feels like a moment where the movie just stops in the way that Spike Lee often does to like shout out famous, you know, Black creators and artists and activists. And I really love those nods to the history because, you know, we talk about the music, we talk about the way it looks, but I also think like the way in which it tries to also just give this weight to Latino culture and history into the film and into the story. And I think it's a really, really beautiful moment to witness.
Yeah. I mean, the love and care and craft that goes into every scene in this movie, I appreciated the tiny little stage Easter eggs peppered throughout. There's a bit, like there are a couple of little Hamilton Easter eggs that there's no sense in spoiling. And so you just see also like not only a desire to represent this culture and this community, but also to represent Broadway, to represent the stage, to represent the theater. It's so lovingly made from top to bottom. I think we agree. we liked this one.
I think so. It sounds like it.
Well, we want to know what you think about In the Heights. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it'll be time to talk about what's making us happy this week. So come right back.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Microsoft Teams. Microsoft Teams is helping Priority Bicycles reinvent the way they work. When the pandemic hit, the bike shop had to close their New York City showroom. They found a way to reopen by doing virtual visits on Teams. Now the team can meet with 2 or 3 times the number of customers than they could before, and people from all over the world can visit their showroom. Learn more about their story and others at Microsoft.com/Teams.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Blue Moon, a refreshingly bright Belgian-style wheat ale brewed with Valencia orange and coriander for a flavor and appearance like nothing else. And now, try the new Blue Moon Light Sky, brewed with tangerine peel. Just 95 calories and 3.6 grams of carbs per 12-ounce can. Have them delivered today at get.bluemoonbeer.com/happyhour. Blue Moon, made brighter. Celebrate responsibly. Blue Moon Brewing Co., Golden, Colorado, Ale.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What's making us happy this week? Aisha Harris, what's making you happy this week, buddy?
Can I get mushy for a moment?
It's a mushy kind of episode.
Actually, it's probably perfect. I've been having some mood swings lately, more than usual. And my partner Ari, one of the things he just does randomly is he always sends me songs. He just texts them to me, and they're like, you know, songs that he thinks I would like, or that, you know, that he likes and that he wants to share with me. And yesterday he shared with me this song called How Can I Make It Okay by Wolf Alice. And Wolf Alice, they just came out with a new album, Blue Weekend. They're a band that I am familiar with, but I can't say I've ever done a deep dive into their music. But the song, I listened to it and it made me cry because it kind of reminded me of the way in which he's always asking me, you know, can I make it okay? How are you doing? I want you to be happy. Those are the lyrics. And this song is just really, really beautiful. It's kind of 80s synth pop. It reminds me a little bit of Haim in the best of ways. How Can I Make It Okay by Wolf Alice is what's making me happy and emotional.
That is a great pick and a great band. I really, really recommend going on a Wolf Alice rabbit hole. Get yourself on YouTube. Watch their Tiny Desk concert. Such a good and interesting band. Thank you, Aisha Harris. Monica Castillo, what's making you happy this week?
So what's been making me happy lately has been the Louis Miguel series on Netflix. Their second season just finished airing on Netflix. It's based on the life of one of Mexico's most recognizable singers. The series takes more of a Shakespearean approach to his personal life, looking at, you know, his controlling father, backstabbing management, and his own personal flaws. He's also haunted by the disappearance of his mother. It really sort of humanizes this myth, like what we think of when we think of this, you know, big famous romantic singer of the 80s and 90s. I'm pretty sure he played at every single wedding I went to in those decades, and maybe even Kings's, because it was like he was like the slow dance king. And he's now also an executive producer on the show. So he's, you know, worked a lot with the star of the show, Diego Boneta, in sort of like fleshing him out as a character and like his performance. And I can't say enough good things about Diego Boneta either, because he's been researching Louis Miguel for years, even before the series started. And it shows. I mean, he plays Louis Miguel from like about 17, 18 to in his 40s. And he mimics all the different body language and the different phases that he was going through in his career almost to a T. I've been watching Louis Miguel's old music videos and then Diego Boneta's performance. And I'm kind of in awe of this, how well he's mimicked that. So it's both like, yes, watch this for a bunch of drama. And if you're curious for, you know, that sort of old school poppy Latin music, you can definitely tune in for that. But also like this really great performance from Diego Boneta.
So that's Luis Miguel, the series. Thank you so much, Monica Castillo. What is making me happy this week is a single play in a single baseball game from May 27th. You might be able to find it if you Google the phrase dumbest play in MLB history. It is between the Chicago Cubs and the Pittsburgh Pirates. The Cubs are up to bat. The batter hits the ball.
Baez hits it on the ground to third.
A simple ground ball. The first baseman, instead of stepping on the bag to end the inning, there are two outs. Literally, all he has to do is take a step back to end the inning. Instead, he tries to chase down the encroaching runner. You really want to watch this. As the runner gets close to home, the first baseman realizes that a runner is advancing to home from third.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. You got to be kidding me.
And, like, pitches the ball to the catcher to try to get the out that way. Remember, all anybody has to do is touch somebody with the ball, and the inning is over. They bobble the ball at home plate. The base runner scores. Then the batter, who was being chased down from first, takes off and runs to first.
Keep going! Go! Go! You're invisible!
They throw the ball to first. They've mishandled the ball so badly that the base runner gets up and steals second. They throw the ball to second and miss by a mile.
That is unbelievable.
That is incredible.
And the entire time, I'm thinking, this is what it was like to play softball for The Onion when I was the coach and co-captain of The Onion softball team back in the late 90s and early aughts. And I have never in my life as a sports viewer watched a play that reminded me of my own athletic prowess. That is very much what is making me happy this week. We will throw a link to that play into our newsletter. We put links to everything we recommended in our newsletter. You can subscribe to that at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at I Dislike Steven. You can follow Aisha at Crafting My Style. You can follow Monica at MCastyMovies. You can follow editor Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy, producer Candace Lim at TheCandaceLim, and producer Jared Gare at Jared M. Gare. That's G-A-I-R. You can follow producer Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides the music you are bobbing your head to right now. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR, and we'll see you all right back here next week.
An internal investigation found that a cop with the California Highway Patrol sexually harassed 21 women. But those findings were kept secret until a new state transparency law passed. We dug through hours of tapes to find out what happens to officers who cross the line. Listen to On Our Watch, a podcast from NPR and KQED.